enormous, great, prodigious fowls, capons, I think, and the doctor kept carving me glorious great bits and passing sausages. I couldn't in decency say no. And then there was an apple pie the bigness of a moderate wheel, and cheese, of course.
What did you drink?
Sherry, wine, claret, and then port.
During his discourse, Gagin had taken off and folded away all his good clothes, and now he was in a striped Guernsey shirt and old sailcloth trousers.
Well, I hope you didn't eat too much. You must take it easy at first.
Many a reefer have I known throw up his dinner merely from topping at the Nimble Ape among the royals and t'gallants too soon after a meal. The ships that blockaded Brest off Ushant or nearer inshore in the bay itself were so very often blown and battered by strong sou'westers, often bringing rain, or by north and north-east winds, which might allow the enemy to come out, therefore calling for the closest attention, that the ship's boys and young gentlemen, to say nothing of the more athletic officers, had little chance of skylarking, and when it came they made the most of it. Stephen Maturin, though very much a spectator aboard, and very much given to standing on the poop or quarter-deck of a healthy ship, in a sickly one he spent most of his time below, and there watching the various manoeuvres, or, in times of relative idleness, the dancing on the forecastle and the skylarking, had rarely seen so numerous a gathering. Right forward there was a fiddler and a man with a tabor playing hornpipes for a close-packed group on the forecastle, where the more expert dancers carried out some very elaborate steps indeed, to the delight of their friends, who clapped hands in time. But what caught his eye more immediately was the number of boys. The Bellona carried 50 or more, officers' servants, apprentices to the gunner, boatswain, carpenter, or the like, and plain ship's boys, and nearly all of them were gathered either along the larboard gangway leading from the quarter-deck to the forecastle, or were already aloft, tearing about among the rigging and sometimes making great swings from one part to another like gibbons, high, high above the deck. Some were racing, some were merely having fun, moving with wonderful ease and certainty. The midshipmen, on the other hand, using the term in its widest sense, from master's mate right down to first-class volunteer, the young gentlemen as a whole, kept to the starboard side, either on the quarter-deck itself, which was their right, or along the starboard gangway. And they, too, were spending much of their time high in the air, apparently weightless, except when they slid with enormous speed down a stay, landing with a thump. While Stephen stood there, a fat midshipman called Dormer, the boy that Gagin was to race, came down the main-to-gallant backstay into the main chains with such force that his knees buckled under him. Stephen helped him over the hammock netting onto the deck, and asked whether the friction didn't scorch his hands. "Not much, sir," he replied with a pleasant confidence, "because now I'm a really hardened old salt, and I check the rush with my feet." He showed his palms, and although they were much stained with tar, there was no trace of a burn. "Now, sir," he said, "I'm going to make the great traverse." "I shall watch you with close attention," said Stephen.
And he certainly meant to do so. But there were such numbers of boys and young men, the Bellona had about 600 people aboard, moving in every direction, up, down, sideways and diagonally, often very fast, that he soon lost sight of Dormer, all the sooner since an ambiguous turn came over together with two gannets. Having fixed the turn, an immature sandwich in a sad state of molt, he returned to his contemplation of the skylarkers, and after a while his earlier impression was confirmed. Although the ship's boys kept to the larboard and the young gentlemen to the starboard, and although there was virtually no direct communication between them, there was, nevertheless, a tacit rivalry. Some uncommonly agile boy, often the boatswain's servant, would perform an exceptional and exceedingly dangerous feat, and with nothing but looks of intelligence between the more expert reefers, their champion would do the same or better. He watched this for some time,
and quite suddenly he recognised young Gagan and the striped Guernsey-shirted boy who was obviously doing his utmost to outpace Dormer on his way up the main topmast rigging. He was clearly less experienced than Dormer, but Dormer had already taken a great deal of exercise. He was fat, and he was tiring fast. They were on opposite sides of the main topmast shrouds, high up where they narrowed to pass through the topgallant cross-trees. Very near the top, where the main topgallant futtock shrouds diverged far from the vertical, Gagan leant backwards, one hand whipping out for the futtock, the other for the forward cross-trees, and here, both holds slipping in his haste, he fell. Fell almost straight, just brushing the main top in his fall, and striking one of the starboard quarterdeck carronades, not a yard from the officer of the watch. Stephen had been walking aft to meet Jack as he came from talking to the master by the wheel. At the general cry he turned, and calling out, "Don't move him!" he ran to Gagan, hoping that there might not be too much damage, that, taken below with great care, he might be recovered. After a moment's examination, he could only report instant death. Jack picked the boy up and carried him into the great cabin, tears running down his face. Later that evening, they sewed him into his hammock, with 32-pound round shot at his feet, and buried him over the side, according to the custom of the sea. The fog increased that night, and Jack spent most of his time on deck, together with Woodbine and Harding, both of them experienced navigators with a fair knowledge of the waters off Brest. The Bellona had lain to near the Amen Rock for the brief ceremony, and she had now to feel her way across some 20 miles of often dangerous water to a point a little west of St. Matthew's. Most of the places had English names, where either the Ramillies or one of her boats would meet her, bringing the Brittany pilot and Stephen's colleague. For tomorrow was the dark of the moon, the time for the landing in Dogleg Cove. Although the very slowly falling glass foretold dirty weather in the near future, Jack felt reasonably confident that he should be able to carry out his plan, which was to beat steadily up and down between the Black Rocks and the Saints by day, as usual, and at nightfall, after the turn of the tide, to double back and run through the Ras de Seine with the current, dropping Stephen as near to the cove as he dared, and then to stand off and wait for the boat anchored south of the Ile de Seine. 12 fathom water and good holding ground. But first, of course, there was the essential rendezvous. And with the log heaved every glass, or sometimes more often, and the lead going steadily, they sailed west by north with the wind 1 point free, the fog streaming across the binnacles and the storm lantern. When, by their very close and concordant reckoning, they were well beyond the Eroise passage, the breeze strengthened, veering northwards. And presently it became obvious that even close-hauled they couldn't reach the channel through the islands they'd hoped for. Jack, therefore, wore ship, and set a necessary but most disagreeable course that would bring them close to the southern fringe of the Black Rocks and their outliers, not always accurately charted. This held until 4 bells in the middle watch. Low tide. When the infernal breeze wavered, grew uneasy, uttered some violent gusts, and hauled a full point forward with every sign of doing worse. Before it could come frankly into the northeast and head him, Jack Aubrey changed course yet again, and stood right across the mouth of the Passage du Four, which had no more than 7 fathoms in some places. The Bellona drew 6. On and on. The 3 men, entirely closed upon their continually developing calculations, all based on the frequent reports of the ship's progress, their informed estimate of her leeway under this trim and with this wind, the ebb and flow of the tide, the force of local currents, The occasional dive into the master's sea cabin abaft the wheel, where by a dim light a chart as accurate as present knowledge would allow, was spread out, and on their own sense of the sea, intuitive, pragmatical, hardly to be reduced to words. I wonder whether the others hear and feel that wicked grind and crack as we strike a reef, said Jack to himself. Probably. He'd felt it this last glass and more as they drew nearer and nearer to St. Matthew's, now perhaps no more than a few cables' length away in the northeast. Then aloud, Mr. Woodbine, do you smell anything? Pause. No, sir. Captain Aubrey, in a carrying voice. Back the main topsail. Start the sheet right forward there. To the man at the wheel. Down with the helm. The way came off the Bellona. She lay there, heaving in the fog, and a voice, some way on her starboard bow, called, "The ship ahoy! What ship's that?" "Bellona," replied Harding. Relief, coupled with the intensity of Woodbine's unspoken question, moved Jack to say, "It's low tide, of course, and I caught a waft of the rotting kelp." When the Ramillies' boat had set both its passengers aboard, he left orders for the officer of the watch. The course due south was safe for the next few hours. Told Harding and the master to get some sleep, and walked softly into the cabin he was sharing with Stephen. "Is all well?" asked Stephen. "Yes. Your man's aboard, and I've put him in the coach. The bosun's looking after the pilot. I'm afraid I woke you." "Not at all, at all. Will you not turn in?" "Scarcely seems worth it. But perhaps I shall." For once, his deep-founded habit of going to sleep at once abandoned him. He lay awake for two bells and the first strokes of a third, working out the letters he was to send to Gagan's parents. As a captain, he'd had to do this several times. It was never easy, but this time the words would scarcely come at all. The cleaning of the deck before sunrise no longer awoke Stephen, but the piping up of hammocks and the sound of bare feet just overhead did so quite abruptly. He stared about, collecting himself, and without surprise he saw Jack come in, pink and obviously new-shaven, even in this dim light. "Good morning to you, my dear," he said. "What of the day?" "Good morning, Stephen. I trust you slept. It's cleared a little, but you still cannot see 100 yards, and we've barely more than steerage way. Do you choose to trim yourself? The sea's smooth, and I can put a famous edge on your razor if you'd like it, and there's your guest. He will breakfast with us, no doubt." "Oh," said Stephen, passing a hand over his jaw, "I'll do admirably for a day or two, until Sunday, indeed. In any case, I know Mr. Bernard well." Mr. Bernard, Inigo Bernard, came from Barcelona, where his family, considerable shipbuilders and shipowners, had been engaged in trade with English merchants for some generations. He'd been educated in England, and he spoke the language perfectly. Yet, like his family, he remained deeply Catalan. Catalan to the extent of bitterly resenting the Spanish oppression of his country, and of supporting the clandestine movement for autonomy, if not downright independence. And it was this that had first brought him and Stephen Maturin together. Yet, in much the same way as Stephen, he had early decided that the French invasion, most particularly atrocious in Catalonia, required him to ally himself with any of the forces that opposed the enemy. In his case, with the Spanish government. He had been more fortunate, though by no means less enterprising than Maturin, as an active member of his secret movement, and his name was to be found on no official lists of rebels or subversive elements. He was, therefore, able to join one of the Spanish intelligence services particularly concerned with naval matters. And when the Spaniards changed sides on the unfortunate advice of the Prince of Peace, and became subservient to Bonaparte, he was very well placed for passing information, above all naval information, to his friend. Even now that Spain was wholeheartedly at war with France once more, their collaboration had its advantages. And the two of them were now engaged on a joint mission. For the French side was by no means a united whole, but contained many people with divided loyalties, to say nothing of double agents. He presented himself for breakfast in the great cabin as trim and properly dressed as his host, which made a good impression. And the meal passed off well, though in a rather formal manner. Jack, in these circumstances, was perfectly discreet, and Bernard was far from expansive, confining himself to generalities and well-received observations about the beauty of the ship, and above all of the truly splendid cabin. After this, Jack left them alone, except for dinner, spending much of his time with Harding, and even more with the boatswain, reinforcing the ship against the expected blow, though he reserved some hours for Jan, marking the Bellona's charts according to his expert advice, and listening to what he had to say about these waters. Soon, perhaps the day after Wednesday, said Jan. He had difficulty with Thursday, though on the whole he was quite fluent. It will settle in the southwest and blow horrid, but I don't have to tell you about preventer staysail, he added, looking with pleasure at the Bellona's rigging. And after a pause he said, I wonder them buggers, nodding towards Brest, didn't try for it when the wind was in the northeast. It was true northeast for a pair of hours after you picked us up. Plenty of time for a frigate to have come down the Goulet in the way by the Héroïse, ni vous ni connu. Or a fast ship of the line, for that matter, like their Romulus. Tell me, Jan, said Jack, if it stays as thick as this, will you undertake to carry the ship through the Raz? With no moonlight at all? As thick as this, sir? I should be happier in a frigate or a sloop than in a heavy great 74 as thick as this. I could do it, because the ebbing tide dashes up so white on the Vieille that I could barely miss it, knowing where to look since I was a boy. He held his hand flattened low down to show his height when first he saw the Vieille. But never make yourself bad blood, sir. It will not stay as thick as this. How true! Towards sunset, when they were lying off the Menglar waiting for the tide, the wind settled in the nor'east again, and although there were patches of true fog still in the east and nor'east over the land, most of the bay to larboard was no more than misty. Indeed, some fishing boats could dimly be seen on the larboard beam half a mile away. Larboard because, at this point, Jack was some way along his northward run, the ordinary routine patrol. When darkness was almost complete, he desired Harding to summon the officer of the watch, Hewell, in this case, the master's mates and midshipmen. And when they were all there on the quarter-deck, he said, Gentlemen, in 15 minutes I shall put the ship about. I should like this manoeuvre to be executed as silently as possible, and with almost nothing in the way of light. And we shall proceed under reefed courses alone. There's no mad hurry. We're not running a race. But let there be no singing out. Each officer must pick his men. This is no caper for raw hands, however stout and willing. Mr. Reed, you've checked the blue cutter, I believe?
Yes, sir, said Reed, smiling in the dark. And I believe all is as you could wish.
Against strong opposition from the more conservative and from his own heart, Jack had rigged davits above the Bellona's quarter-galleries, taking away somewhat from her beauty and committing an innovation. But now he rejoiced in the thought of that boat hanging there fully equipped, ready to be stepped into by the less expert, and lowered down without danger, without anxiety on either part. He'd put Stephen ashore in many and many a place, generally by night, and the anguish, even in a dead calm sea, of watching his unsteady, lurching journey down the side, though helped by gravity and devoted hands, had added years to his apparent age. Any innovation, however barbarous, was worth the relief of seeing him sitting there with his hands folded, his baggage beside him, and the whole container and contents very gently descending until it touched the surface, with Bomden there to fend off, and the cutter's crew leaping down like cats. All this, however, in the future. Once the ship had been put about, which was done with creditable speed in near silence, and once she was heading south by east under reefed courses with the wind a little abaft the beam, as inconspicuous as a ship of the line could ever hope to be, her captain's station was in the foretop with the pilot, an attentive midshipman on deck to relay his orders. For a long while there were no orders to relay. Jack and the pilot discussed the clearing of the mist, likely to be complete by the morning, the Bellona's leeway very slight, and her present position. On the starboard bow, sir, you can just make out the bar then. The course half a point to larboard, sir, if you please. Thus, very well thus. And was it there you would see Dead Man's Bay to leeward? A long silence, in which they heard the muted strokes of five bells in the first watch. Now, sir, said Jan, we are well into the rise, the tide running 3 knots and more, and in 10 minutes on the larboard bow, if God wishes, you will see the white water on the Vieille. This westerly breeze across the strong ebb should throw it quite high. Jack stared hard over the larboard bow. His eyes were perfectly accustomed to the darkness, yet they were not what they had been. One had been damaged in battle. My solitary point in common with Nelson, he'd once said when half seas over, and had blushed for it afterwards. It was Jan who cried, "There she is! Just a little more forward, sir." And presently Jack caught it, a rhythmic whiteness that travelled from left to right in time with the moderate roll of the ship. "Now, sir," said Jan, when they'd contemplated this for a while, "if we steer southeast, we should come as near as I dare take you to Dogleg Cove in half an hour." "Thank you, pilot," said Jack. "Lie to, if you please, when we are as close in as you think fit. I shall take my measures." He climbed out of the top with a nonchalant ease of one to whom shrouds and ratlins were as natural a path as a flight of stairs, and walked along the dark, silent gangway aft. In the cabin, its lamp hidden from without by deadlights, he found Stephen and Bernard playing chess. Stephen frowned. Bernard made as though to get up, but Jack begged him to remain seated and finish the game. There was perhaps half an hour left. "Shall we call it a draw?" asked Bernard after what seemed to Jack an endless pause of the most intense concentration. "Never in life," said Stephen. "Let me record the position, and with the blessing we shall play it out another day." "Stephen," said Jack, "have you any messages, requests, letters you should like me to send?" Before action, he and Stephen usually exchanged wills and the like. "Not this time, my dear. I thank you very kindly. Lawrence holds all 3 farthings I possess, and dear Diana knows just what I should wish." "Then perhaps we should think of getting ready. The ship will heave to in a very little while. The sea is still, and for the moment, fairly smooth. And although you'll be 15 minutes before your time, I'd sooner set you both ashore with dry coats upon your backs and—" "Come in." It was a midshipman. "Mr. Harding's duty, sir, and there's a light on shore, winking 3 times, then 1. Stephen nodded and said, "Let's go." Their meagre baggage was already in the boat. Jack led them across the darkened deck, absurdly hand in hand, helped them into the cutter, and leaning down grasped Stephen's shoulder with an iron grip by way of farewell. He heard the sheaves turn smoothly. "Handsomely, handsomely," murmured the boatswain, saw the boat touch and bob. Bonden shoved off. Jack called, "Row dry there," and watched the cutter pull away towards the still winking light. When at last it went out, he turned from the rail, gave the orders that would carry the Bellona to her anchorage, and went below, deeply sad. He'd seen Stephen off like this many and many a time, but his grief and anxiety never grew less. As he went, he noticed a dim star or two in the zenith, and by the time the boat rejoined with Bonden's report that there was a parcel of gents on the beach talking foreign but right glad to see the doctor, carried him and his mate ashore dry foot, there was a fine sprinkling of them with Saturn in the middle, and they so clear and sharp that their light showed him not only the now much greater surf breaking on the reef south of the Ile de Seine, but the black, rugged outline of the island itself.
Chapter 6. The grief and anxiety didn't die away, but of necessity they receded, and as the Bellona worked her way tack upon tack round the Saints to regain the bay at dawn, the top of his mind was taken up with the handling of the ship, and with a very close watch to see just what harm the lax but harsh command of his jobbing captain had done. He'd already looked through the recent gunnery records, which contained no account whatsoever of live firing, only of rattling the great guns in and out. The log, on the other hand, spoke of frequent flogging, more punishment than Jack would have inflicted in a quarter. At one bell in the morning watch, the Bellona's tender, the Ringle, now commanded by that valuable young man Reed, a fast, weatherly, sweet-sailing schooner with much less draught than the great 74, hailed to say that she was shoaling her water. 10 fathoms, then 9. "What you say, Jan?" asked Jack. The pilot was standing at his side. "What him bottom?" "Arm you, lad," called Jack. And shortly after, the reply came back across the calm, gently heaving sea. "Hake's teeth and white sand, if you please, sir."
"Carry on, sir," said Jan. "Next cast 10, 11, 12.
A presence behind him, and a very agreeable smell. "Which I thought you might like some coffee, sir," said Killick, passing the mug. "The doctor said it preserved the frame from falling damps."
"Bellona," called the tender. 9 fathoms, if you please."
A pause.
10 and grey sludge."
Jan nodded with satisfaction. "If we carry on till come 2 bells, and then wear ship and stand east, southeast, and half-east, we fine. We all right, sir." At 2 bells the idlers were called. The sentinels all round the ship cried, "All's well." The mate of the watch, having heaved the log, reported to Miller, third lieutenant and officer of the watch, 4 knots exactly, sir, if you please." And this he wrote on the logboard, together with the Bellona's present course of south-southwest. The hawser of the carpenter's mates whispered, 4.5 inches in the well, sir," into Miller's ear. And Miller, turning to the captain and taking off his hat, repeated all this to him in a voice calculated to be heard above the din of hand-pumps, buckets, swabs, and holy stones of various sizes that were preparing to clean the deck in the first half-lights of the coming day. But before they could begin, Jack called, "Belay there!" And more gently, "Mr. Miller, we will wear ship, if you please, and stand east, southeast, and half-east. The watch will suffice." Jack rarely tacked a line of battleship when he had sea-room to wear her, letting her head fall off from the wind and come right round to the desired bearing. It was slower and less spectacular than coming up into the wind's eye, crossing through and steadying on the new course, but it called for fewer hands, and it preserved both spars and rigging. He now watched the manoeuvre attentively. It was carried out smoothly. Not very fast, but smoothly, with no bellowing or damming of eyes. And when the quartermaster at the con, seeing the compass dead on the true bearing, called to the helmsman, "Thus, thus, very well, thus," Jack went below, reasonably satisfied, but still low in his spirits. He hated to think of Stephen wandering about there on a hostile shore, among so many more or less trustworthy foreigners. He sat there, reflecting, while the series of bells that had accompanied his life at sea for so many years continued their unchanging pace, bringing up hammocks with a fine rush of feet at the 7th set of strokes, and news of breakfast at the 8th. Almost the only advantage of being on the Brest blockade was that the victuals were usually fresh and plentiful, and breakfast, perhaps Jack's favourite meal apart from dinner,
was fairly sure of being able to provide capital sausages and bacon, while the hens, and the Bologna was unusually well found in poultry, being still in something like their native air, gave almost a superfluity of eggs. Yet this was a lonely breakfast. Obviously, in the nature of things, the captain of a man-of-war, above all, one who couldn't afford to keep a table, and this was Jack's case at present, must eat many and many a solitary meal. But for a great while Jack Aubrey had sailed with Stephen Maturin, and now he missed his companion quite severely. A wholly human and often contradictory companion, essentially different from the only other guests he could invite, lieutenants, master's mates, or midshipmen, who were all debarred by custom and by common prudence from disagreeing with the skipper on any point whatsoever, and who in any case were not to speak until they'd been spoken to.
"Come in," he called.
"Sir," said a midshipman, opening the cabin door, "Mr. Summers' compliments and duty, and the Alexandria is in sight."
"Thank you, Mr. Weatherby. Is she within signalling distance?"
"Oh, sir, I'm sure I can't tell," said Weatherby, aghast. He was a first voyager. "Shall I run up and ask?"
"Never trouble. I shall be on deck directly." "She might conceivably be bringing us our post," reflected Jack. "How I should love a fat parcel of letters, news of the girls, word of the village and that reptile Griffiths, and perhaps the proceedings will be out." He'd combined his last visit to London but one to criticise the naval estimates in the Commons as member for Millport, and to reading a second paper on the precession of the equinoxes to the Royal Society as a fellow of that august and learned body. For he was a late-blooming but quite highly esteemed mathematician, specialising in the problems of celestial navigation. Uncommon mathematical and musical abilities are quite often to be found in men wholly ignorant of the laws of prosody, and barely capable of assembling 20 words of prose in a passably elegant, coherent, and grammatical form. "And there might even be an encouraging letter from Lawrence," he went on. But the word letter reminded him of the shockingly painful one to the Reverend Mr. Gagan that he must write out fair. He could scarcely ask his clerk to do so, in order that it should go to the flag as soon as possible. And to change the current of his mind, he swallowed the last of his coffee and walked forward along the quarter-deck, all its inhabitants silently moving over to the larboard side as he appeared. "Where away?" he asked.
2 points on the starboard bow, sir," said Summers, the officer of the watch. And two of the midshipmen exchanged a knowing look, for most of the people could see her perfectly well. It was fully day now, though the sun was still hidden by cloud low over the distant land, and there was mist over the sea itself. And presently Jack, bringing his good eye to bear with a now habitual twist of his neck, made out the little frigate, her sails whiter than the whiteness between the two ships.
"She's heading for the Black Rocks," said Jack. "Has she uttered?"
"She dipped a topsail, sir," said Summers, "but that was probably just Captain Naismith's fun."
"Give her a waft," said Jack,
who was much senior to Naismith, the frigate's commander, "and throw out desire to speak to you." The signal midshipman, an oldster named Callow, who had sailed with Jack before, and the yeoman were expecting this, and the signal raced up, breaking out directly. The Alexandria put before the wind, spread stunsails, and began throwing a bow wave, most creditable in this moderate breeze.
"Say, dice, come no higher," called Jack. "Then, have you any news, any letters?"
A short pause, in which all the telescopes on the Bologna's quarter-deck focused earnestly upon the frigate. And even before Callow could read out the answer, an audible sigh arose from the quicker-minded watchers.
"No news, sir. No letters. Regret. Repeat, regret."
Reply, many thanks, the Lord will provide. Carry on.
The Alexandria carried on, vanishing entirely within half an hour as their courses diverged, Jack beating up for his usual station at this time of day of Dinan Point, where he might possibly fall in with the Ramillies coming down from St. Matthew's, or one of the cutters that plied between the squadrons. But for the time being he was to attend to the young gentlemen. They were gathering there on the quarter-deck behind him, accompanied by the schoolmaster, and although some were furtively giggling, treading on one another's toes, most were decently apprehensive.
"Very well, gentlemen, let's begin," said Jack, in their direction, and he led the way into the fore cabin. Here they showed up their day's workings, which, as there'd been no noon observation the day before, were necessarily the product of dead reckoning, and they differed little, except in neatness. Both Walkinshaw and Jack were perfectly at home with the mathematics of navigation, and it was difficult for either to understand how very deeply ignorant it was possible for the young and feather-brained to be, particularly those young men who'd spent most of their schooltime ashore learning Latin, and in some cases Greek, and even a little Hebrew, possibly some French. This occurred to Jack with some force in the silence that followed his commendation of the neat and his giving back the workings. And out of this silence he said to a dwarfish 12-year-old, the son of one of his former lieutenants, "Mr. Thompson, what is meant by a sign?" He glanced round the general blankness and went on, "Each of you take a piece of paper and write down what is meant by a sign. Mr. Weller," this to a boy who had been to a nautical academy at Wapping, "you're whispering to your neighbour. Jump up to the masthead and stay there until you're told to come down. But before you go, gather the papers and show them to me." It was difficult to tell whether the schoolmaster or his pupils felt the more distressed, as the captain looked through the undeniable proof of such very complete ignorance of the first elements. "Very well," he said at last, "we shall have to start again with the ABC. Pass the word for my joiner." The joiner appeared, brushing chips from his apron. "Hemmings," said Jack, "run me up a blackboard, will you? A flat, dead paint that'll take chalk handsomely, and let me have it by this time tomorrow." To the youngsters he said, "I shall write definitions and draw diagrams, and you'll get them by heart." He was not in the best of moods, and his absolute determination, together with his bulk and his immense authority on board, was singularly impressive. They filed out in silence, looking grave. The next morning the blackboard was present, fixed by thumbscrews within easy reach of the captain's hand, and from it the boys were taught, with words and diagrams, the nature of sine, cosine, tangent, cotangent, secant and cosecant, the relations between them, and their value in helping to find your position in a prodigious ocean, no shore, no landmark for 10,000 miles. All these things were to be found in Robinson's Elements of Navigation, which, together with the requisite tables and nautical almanac, lay in their sea-chests, a necessary part of their equipment. And Mr. Walkinshaw had tried to lead the youngsters through them, but nothing came anywhere near the concentrated, forceful instructions of Jove himself. And after what seemed an anxious eternity to the midshipman's berth, but which in fact lasted no more than a few of the Bellona's usual patrols from Duanene Bay to the Black Rocks, in hazy, sometimes foggy weather, in which they saw nothing at all, and sometimes with such light airs that on occasion they lacked even steerage way, and the captain had all the time in the world for trigonometry. Yet Thursday came at last. A blessed Thursday. A make-and-mend day when the mist cleared. A decent breeze blew from the northeast, and the youngsters sat in the sun on the forecastle with their sea-daddies showing them how to darn their stockings, or mend torn clothes, or tie the simple knots and learn the elements of splicing. A Thursday on which the lookout at the masthead hailed,
On deck there! A ship's topsails right to leeward!
Presently, most of those who felt they could be spared below were aloft with telescopes, and after a while it was found that she was the Ramillies, now lying to and presumably watching some suspect sail northwards along the Passage du Fort, out of sight from the Bellona. No sooner was this agreed to by all than a second vessel was seen, a cutter coming from the direction of Ushant, beyond the Black Rocks, and then even a third, the heavy frigate Doris. After such loneliness, the bay seemed positively crowded. The Ramillies was a right welcome sight to all hands, and particularly to Jack. Their captain, Billy Fanshawe, was an old friend of his. So indeed was the Doris. But what really delighted every man aboard, including those who could neither read nor write, was the identification of the cutter as one belonging to the flagship and employed for distribution of the mail throughout the squadron under Admiral Stranraer's command. The Doris, out in the offing, had altered course to intercept the cutter well before the Bellona and she had her letters first, although Harding, who'd left his wife expecting her first child, spread an unreasonable amount of canvas. Yet quite soon the Bellona's grim, discontented looks gave way to tense and happy anticipation. The cutter came neatly alongside, seized the net dangling from the whip to the mainyard, put a fine round mail sack into it, and sped off towards the distant Ramillies. The sack was carried hot-foot to the great cabin, where Jack, the first lieutenant, and the clerk sorted it. From the cabin it filtered down first to the wardroom, then by way of the clerk to the warrant officers and petty officers, and then by way of the midshipmen to the ratings of their particular divisions. Jack's mail obviously stayed where it was, and as soon as the cabin door had closed behind Harding and the clerk, he seized the first on the pile, a letter addressed, and badly addressed, in that most familiar of hands. They'd parted on indifferent terms, and he opened it with the liveliest expectation of all their affection being fully restored, smiling as he did so. The letter was dated from Woolcombe on the 14th. With these northerly winds it had taken no more than 5 days. Mr. Aubrey, it is with a deepest, the very deepest concern, that I must tell you I have been shown unanswerable proof of your infidelity. In open contempt of your promise before God's altar, you lay with a woman called Amanda Smith in Canada and got her with child. Deny it if you can. I have the proofs, and I mean to take advice. In the meantime, I shall give the Admiral notice to leave my house at Ashgrove and return there with the children.
Then came some tear-blotted and scratched-out lines. The obviously composed and recopied letter now abandoned its original and improvised, grew far less coherent, far less legible. He just made out the words, "You left her bed and came into mine," when he was called on deck.
"Sir," said Harding, "you asked me to tell you if Ramillies gave any sign of life. This last minute she's thrown out our number and, Captain, repair aboard. I've acknowledged and given word to ready your barge."
"Thank you, Mr. Harding," said Jack.
"Make all suitable sail, if you please."
He returned to the cabin, and having sat for a while, he reached out for the other letter from Sophie, and opened it with a hesitant, almost trembling hand. The date was a week before that which he'd just read, the writing more wholly familiar. "My dearest Jack, how sorry I am to have sent you off so shabbily, and for a great while I've been meaning to beg pardon for my bad temper, trying to tell you how even a most loving heart, a female heart, can be affected by the ill-humoured moon. But these things are very hard for a sadly ignorant creature to set down on paper so that the words give any real picture of her feelings, and before I'd written anything but odd headings such as love and kisses and forgiveness, a letter came from Bath with the most frightful news. You'll certainly remember that Mama lived with a friend called Mrs. Morris, the Honourable Mrs. Morris, who helped her with the business, and that they had a man-servant, a worthless fellow we all disliked when they lived here, particularly your seaman. But he was useful in the business because he understood horse-racing and the laying of odds. Well, Mrs. Morris has run off with him, apparently taking all the money and anything else they could carry, and when Mama heard they were married, legally married, in a church, she fell down senseless and had to be bled, and she's had fits ever since, laughing and crying. With dear Diana's help, I brought her back here. She'd almost destroyed their apartment in Pulteney Street, and anyhow she wasn't fit to live there alone. The servants, apart from old Molly, had all left, and I'm afraid she behaved dreadfully in the coach. And since the girls are back from school, bringing friends with them, the little Nugent children, I've had to put her in your study, so near the necessary room. But do not fear. We've put a bed in the left-hand corner with a wardrobe and a chest of drawers behind it. I cannot tell you how kind dear Mrs. Oakes has been. And she will never come near your precious ship models or surveying instruments. When you come on leave, and oh, may it be soon, my love, and when the holiday girls and their friends are gone, we will move her upstairs, or possibly back to Bath with a much more suitable companion. She says there's a clergyman who is on the brink of making her an offer. Dear Jack, please do not worry about having money sent to me for housekeeping. We're very well with what comes from the farm, the dairy, the kitchen garden, and my poultry yard, but even if it were not for them, Diana absolutely insists on giving us a very handsome rent for her wing of the house and the stabling. Such stabling, now, such horses! With the help of the gentleman who lent her the coach, she took you and Stephen down in, she has it yet, she pawned that enormous great blue diamond she brought back with her from America. "Be damned to living on £200 a year," she cried, "and is launching into breeding Arabs again. And although that sad place at Barham's not yet sold, she's taken all Mears pasture for them. She said it was absurd to keep the Blue Peter, as they call it, hidden away in a jeweller's case. She couldn't wear it at our Dorchester assemblies, only in London or Paris. And in any case, she'd soon have it again once Stephen's affairs were in order. She looks forward extremely to a coach and six." Jack laid the paper down, and in a dull, heavy way he wondered how he had come to be so deeply foolish as to leave Amanda's letters in a square cardboard box among his official and business correspondence. A certain liking, a certain gratitude had prevented him from balling them up and throwing them away. There would have been an indecency in doing so, in spite of her extreme silliness. He felt no particular guilt except for this foolishness. By his code, a man who was directly challenged must, in honesty, engage. Anything else would be intolerably insulting. Yet had he known of this miserable old woman's prying and her malice, he would certainly have played the scrub in Canada. He reflected on Sophie's general attitude towards these matters. Her extreme disapproval of any irregularity, any levity in speaking of even a looseness that reached nowhere near as far as criminal conversation. For her looseness in conversation was criminal, almost in the lawyer's sense of the term. "Sir," said his first lieutenant, "forgive me for bursting in on you, but your barge is lowering down, and, sir, may I tell you, Eleanor and I have a daughter, healthy, pink, and cheerful." "Give you joy of her with all my heart, William," said Jack, crushing his hand. "And Mrs. Harding, too, of course. I'm sure that she'll turn out to be a good un." The ceremony of the side, and the captain of the Bellona, preceded by a midshipman, stepped into the boat. Bondon shoved off. The bargemen gave way, pulling a fine even stroke across the 50 yards to the Ramillies. The ceremony of the side again. Captain Aubrey piped aboard and kindly greeted by Captain Fanshawe, his senior by a short neck, who led him into the cabin, placed a glass of brandy in his hand, and with a curiously embarrassed air said, "Well, Jack, I hope you had an agreeable post." "Not quite what I could have wished as far as I've looked," said Jack.
But perhaps something better may appear. How was yours?
A charming letter from Dolly, and quite good news of the children. The rest was mostly bills. But, Jack, I'm truly sorry to say the cutter also brought me an order from the flag. I am required to acquaint you that on the night you received a pilot from Ramillies and shaped a course for the Ras du Seine, two French frigates sailed from Brest with the wind at nor'east and are now attacking British and Allied merchantmen with great success. This cannot but be attributed to your negligence in not keeping a good lookout, since from all appearance the Frenchmen must have crossed your wake. I am therefore to reprimand you severely, and you are hereby severely reprimanded.
Yes, sir, said Jack without expression. Is that all?
No, replied Fanshawe, with more expression than he intended, and with his eyes on the paper in front of him. I am also under orders to require you to proceed off Ushant without the loss of a moment and to report to the flag. There you will be attached to the offshore squadron, where it's hoped that other and perhaps sharper eyes will diminish the very grave consequences of such unseemly negligence.
A silence.
Neither intended to comment on the Admiral's prose.
"Will you dine with me, Jack?"
asked Fanshawe in an attempt at an ordinary conversational tone. "Thank you very much, Billy," said Jack, "but without the loss of a moment stands in the way. And between ourselves, my post acquainted me that I've been taken in adultery without a goddamn leg to stand on and that there's the devil to pay. It destroys a man's appetite, you know."
"Oh, my dear Jack, I know, cried Fanshawe with great feeling. "I know only too well. Come, drink up your brandy and I'll see you over the side."
Coming aboard the Bellona again, Jack returned the many salutes, walked into his cabin where the letters were still strewn over a medley of unopened covers, and sent for the master. "Mr. Woodbine," he said, "pray shape a course for Ushant, for wherever the offshore squadron is most likely to be lying at this state of the tide and in the particular wind, or whatever wind we find out there. Indeed, the winds the offshore squadron experienced were generally very much harder than those that blew eastward of Ushant, especially the great sou'westers, from whose full force and from whose prodigious seas the inshore ships were protected to some degree by the chain of the Saints, which acted as a not very efficient but still appreciable breakwater. And this was even more evident in the Chenal de la Helle, which Woodbine took that afternoon. They made good progress, and although the topsails had to be double-reefed on reaching the wholly unprotected Passage de Fromvaux, it was clear that the wind was diminishing. On the other hand, the monstrous sea it had worked up on the far side of the island was, if anything, greater still, in spite of the heavy rain by the time they reached the squadron, lying to off the stiff bay in the nor'east. And when Jack, in response to the flagship's captain, "Repair aboard," made his way down into his wildly heaving barge, he missed his footing for once, and with his boat cloak flying about his ears, he fell plump into the water swirling about the boat's bottom. Much more water joined it on the way across, and it was a damp Jack Aubrey that stood waiting for his interview with the Admiral aboard the Charlotte. A long wait, and although Charles Morton, her captain, was civil enough, Jack knew perfectly well that a man who was very much out of favour, who had just received a reprimand, a severe reprimand, was a dangerously infectious leper, above all in a ship governed by Stranraer, and he inflicted neither his remarks nor his presence on any of the officers about him. When he was taken into the Admiral's cabin, he found that the captain of the fleet was also present, sitting at Stranraer's side behind a long table set athwartship, with the Admiral's secretary and a clerk at the larboard end. "Good evening, my lord," he said.
"Good evening, sir."
"Good evening, Captain Aubrey," said the Admiral. "Sit down. Now,
What have you to say about these French frigates you allowed to slip past you?"
"I have only to say that I very much regret any Frenchman should have got out of Brest."
"Then you admit they went by?"
"I must have expressed myself badly, my lord. I expressed nothing but regret at what he said to have taken place. I acknowledge no sort of responsibility."
"Where was your ship at sunset on the 27th?
"2 cables north of the Mengla, my lord, waiting for the tide."
"Then how do you explain the fact that 2 frigates could leave the Goulet de Brest, run out by the Héroïse, and be seen a league north of the Ile de Seine 3/4 of an hour later, without they passed astern of you, almost within hail, certainly in sight?"
"I do not explain it at all, my lord.
But I will assert that there was a lookout at each masthead, and of course on the forecastle, able seamen of known reliability." "So you deny the possibility of the Frenchman's getting past unseen?"
"I do not deny it. The weather was uncommon thick at times that afternoon and night. The pilot had to feel his way along past the Bassier by the flash of surf. And it's not impossible that she passed unseen. What I do deny is the possibility of her doing so through the fault or negligence of any of my people."
"So you blame it all on the weather, do you?"
"If blame there should be, I should certainly lay it on the fog, my lord." The admiral looked at Calvert, the captain of the fleet, and the officer principally concerned with discipline.
"What do you say?"
Calvert, a cold, withdrawn man, tall for a sailor and thin, looked dispassionately at Jack for a moment and said,
"In cases of this kind, there's much to be said for gathering all the available objective evidence. Not only does the ship in question keep a logbook with remarks on the weather, but there are also the officers' and midshipmen's journals. If there should ever become an important disciplinary matter, if there should be the least question of anyone asking for a court-martial, they would certainly have to be looked at."
Stranraer considered.
The clerk mended his pen.
"Oh, I don't think it'll come to that," said the admiral at last. "If Captain Aubrey will solemnly declare that his ship was in a state of full preparedness on the 27th, I shall rest content."
Jack made the declaration.
Stranraer stood up, saying, "Then let's leave it at that."
"Certainly, my lord. But if you'll allow me, I have a request to make. A request for leave."
"Leave?" cried Stranraer. "Not more leave, for God's sake. Parliamentary leave again."
"No, my lord, for urgent private affairs."
"No, that really will not do. If every officer or seaman, for that matter, were to go home every time there was an urgency in his private affairs, we should never be able to man the fleet. It's not a sudden death, I trust."
"No, my lord."
"Then let's hear no more about it. Ours is a hard service, as you know very well, and this is wartime."
Certainly it was a hard service. And neither Admiral Stranraer nor the autumnal gales had the least intention of making it any less so. The squadron was drilled, and most rigorously drilled, in all weathers short of a close-reefed topsail blow. Towards the end of the day, boats would be seen carrying apprehensive captains across to the flag to hear the admiral's candid opinion of their seamanship. His notion of drill was curious, rather like that of the army of an earlier age, when precision of button, pipeclay, and movement counted for almost everything, together with evolutions such as countermarches, which had very little to do with war, an activity that might easily spoil a uniform. Lord Stranraer had little use for gunfire. He would certainly have grappled with the French had they come out, but during his very frequent drills the great guns generally lay idle, shining wherever polish was in any way appropriate, and housed with perfect regularity. It was something like the West Indian discipline transported to the Channel, where it made even less sense than it had in the Caribbean. Although he was constantly forming and reforming the line of battle, with the rear becoming the van and the van becoming the rear, combat itself didn't really seem to interest the admiral. He had in his youth been concerned in a certain number of actions in which he'd not behaved with discredit, but he pinned all his faith in the moral force of a large, intact fleet, impeccably expert in all possible manoeuvres, and professionally far in advance of any possible rival, a body that would silently impose its will. However, these drills did at least keep Jack Aubrey very fully occupied indeed. He was extremely unwilling to have his ship, and, by inference, his ship's company, picked out for harsh signals. Bellona's number showing clear aboard the flag or the repeating frigate, followed by "Keep your station," or "Make more sail," or some telegraphic remark such as "Look alive," or "Do you need assistance?" And since Bellona's crew, though a very fair body for the purpose of fighting the ship, at present included more than a fair share of landmen, and, which was even more important, had never at any time been worked up to this kind of stopwatch performance in anything but gunnery, he and his officers had to do their very utmost to anticipate the next order. A wearing task, and one in which they weren't always successful. The Bellona's barge, therefore, often joined those who were summoned aboard the flag at the end of the exercise to be told their faults by their rough-tongued admiral. Jack didn't enjoy these sessions, but they didn't touch him deeply, even when the strictures were deserved, which, with such a crew as his, was sometimes inevitable, because his mind was in a very curious state of hurry, confusion, and distress. Except when it was taken up with the day-long task of making his ship give as good an account of herself in a highly competitive series of operations, often in heavy weather, his mind ran on that letter and on the stranger who'd written it. Innumerable possibilities came crowding, and an immense sadness alternated with a perhaps still greater frustration, which took the form of a longing for battle. This was clearly obvious to those that knew him well, and even the captain of the fleet, not an exceptionally percipient man, handled him with care aboard the Charlotte. On his own quarter-deck he awarded no punishment. There was little need, but occasionally he'd clap his jaw shut on some intended rebuke, and this had an effect far more marked than any blasphemous roar. "I hope to God he don't explode," said anxious, unhappy Killick. "God help the poor bugger he explodes upon," said Bondon. Solution, or at all events relief, through the very great and varied emotion of battle, came in sight on a